Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from the podcast that is called Books of the Year, the podcast.
We are relentless, aren't we? We are like Mo Salah and Luis Diaz powering through the...
To one point.
Yes.
Against Man City. I mean, come on.
Oh, dear.
Before we get to this week's correspondence, just wanted to mention the British Book Industry Awards. Shortlists have just been announced, and it's great to see some of our choices from last year on the list.
Oh, right.
Damascus Station by David McCloskey has been nominated for Crime and Thriller Book of the Year. And The Ghost Ship by Kate Moss, shortlisted for Fiction Book of the Year. So congratulations to both of those books and to all the shortlistees. That sounds like a clumsy word.
Shortlistees, I'm not sure that is a word.
People on the shortlist.
Yes, people on the shortlist. That's what I'm going to say.
And you can hear both David and Kate discussing those books on previous episodes of the pod.
Okay, now obviously you can always get in contact with us via email or Twitter or X or whatever, but we have an email here.
Or Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, yeah, no. Do keep pushing the Blue Sky. An email from Rachel in Basingstoke who says, hello Simon, hello Matt. I'm a regular listener to the pod and very much enjoy your Q&A episodes. One of the questions which often comes up is about screen adaptations of books, and it got me thinking about my favourite. I think it's the original Murder on the Orient Express, the Sidney Lumet version from 74, with Albert Finney as Poirot. I'm not sure it's the greatest of all adaptations ever, but I've seen it about 10 times and find it very comforting and enjoyable every time I see it, says Rachel.
Because there's nothing quite so comforting as murder.
Murder. But it is, I'll tell you what that movie is. So we've got it on our sort of box where you can just, you know, watch it anytime you want. And it is perfect Saturday afternoon material, chucking it down outside, get a fire going, and a bit of Murder on the Orient Express, where you already know what happens. Everyone knows the plot to Murder on the Orient Express.
Mm-hmm.
But not going to spoil it now, obvs. But it's perfect. Sit down and just let it envelop you kind of material.
If you want to answer any of the questions that we ask the authors, then you can, of course. What is our email? I can't remember.
Books of the Year.
Books of the Year@yahoo.com.
There you go.
Could have given my home email again.
Again, yes, yeah.
Mary Claire on Twitter, a quick shout out to East Dunbartonshire Library, who are saving me from Books of the Year induced bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
I recently borrowed All the Sinners Bleed by S.A. Crosby, dark, grim, atmospheric, and brilliantly written. Well, that's very good. Yes, so if you are one of the many people that just hear us talk about a book and then think, oh, I better get that.
Yeah.
This is quite an expensive
yes,
podcast.
Yeah,
so let's hear it for East Dunbartonshire Library.
Yes, and it is worth saying, you can, you know, pick and choose which books, but all the books we bring you are books that we think are worth your time. And finally, this from Effie Bernstein says, The Restless Republic, which of course we had on in the podcast before this one, was one of my favourite reads over the last couple of years. Loved hearing Anna on the podcast. If you haven't read her book yet, you must, which we would echo.
That's Anna Key.
Anna Kay, we decided.
Anna Kay, in the UK.
In the UK, okay.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can email booksoftheyear@yahoo.com, Twitter, Books of the Year, Instagram and Threads, pick any page. I'm also on Blue Sky.
You're also on Blue Sky.
Although no one else is.
No, dear.
Right, let's talk to today's special guest, screenwriter and author, all-round good geezer, John O'Farrell. So John O'Farrell is on our podcast. John, how do you? Nice to see you.
Thank you for having me on. Great
to
be here.
Family Politics is the name of John's book. It may well be that you've been following John's work for a long time. Things Can Only Get Better. Was that 98?
25 years ago it is, yeah.
Wow.
But that was fantastic. You know, that was, everyone goes, oh, right, have you read this book by John O'Farrell? It's absolutely fantastic. So a lot of us have been following you since then.
Well, fantastic. Thank you. Flattered.
Matt, describe the cover of this candy floss.
So, yeah, it is. I was going to say candy stripe, isn't it? The sort of wallpaper, pink and white affair. And we've got three little pigs flying across the front cover. But crucially, two of them have got red wings and they're flying in one direction. But the smallest one has blue wings and is flying in the opposite direction. What could that mean? John O'Farrell in big black bold letters at the top, Family Politics. In similar font at the bottom, and then Sunday Times best-selling author in the middle.
Just want to say, John, while I remember, and just to put you in a good frame of mind.
Yes.
I was doing an interview for Dune 2.
Oh, yes.
And was about to interview Denis Villeneuve and Hans Zimmer. And I went up in the lift with Hans Zimmer. And so we were, you know, we were chatting away, and which is very nice. And he said, I've just been to the theatre.
Yes.
And he'd just been to see your musical.
Oh, fantastic.
Just one day, just for one day.
That's right.
Just for one day.
And I was thinking, okay, I knew you were coming on the pod. I said, yes. I was thinking, I hope the next bit of this comes, because this is Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, I went with Pete Townsend and...
Bob Geldof?
No, he didn't mention Geldof. Anyway, he said it was fantastic.
Oh, well, that's...
And he said the band could play and the singers could sing, and he absolutely loved it.
Great. That would have been opening night if Pete Townsend was there, our big press night. And Hans Zimmer, I'm a big fan.
Hans Zimmer, Trevor Horn, that was the other person.
Oh, Trevor Horn, that's so cool. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad they like my musical.
But I mean, I was just thinking, that is fantastic. You know, Hans Zimmer, probably, you know, the most successful modern composer who's out there. Former member of Buggles and obviously all those other things, but he went to your musical.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that
he couldn't wait to talk about it.
That opening night, there were loads of stars from Live Aid, because the show's about Live Aid, for those listeners who don't know what it's about. It's a sort of dramatisation of how Bob Geldof and various other people made that event happen. But there's 18 hours of music in those two concerts, and I had to get it down to like two and a bit. So there were various celebs and showbiz stars and old pop stars from the 80s there that night, some of whom I hadn't used in my musical. So I was hiding behind pillars and sort of like not wanting to meet certain 80s pop stars in case they went, why didn't you use me at all? It's embarrassing.
So who got the chop?
There's no Duran Duran in the show. There's no Beach Boys, who are fantastic. Wow. There's no Led Zepp. I don't think we would have got the rights for Led Zepp anyway. And yet, you know, there's some bands who are very well featured, like Queen and Bowie and Elton John. So it swings and roundabouts. But, you know, you have to make theatrical decisions and you have to make narrative choices. And that was a big factor in the songs that we chose.
And this is going to come onto your writing, obviously, because and you also wrote Chicken Run 2. You know, so you're a, you know, screenwriter and novelist and memoirist.
Indeed. That's a good word.
The right word. But you must have known when you started the... Your musical based on Live Aid, that you were going to have to work with Sir Bob Geldof.
Yes.
I think you described him on the radio as a
challenging. Challenging. I mean, I've grown to love him, but he was as you know, history will record, he's quite a forthright person. Yes. And he has every right to say to me, that's not what I felt at the time, that's not how I would have said it. What he doesn't have is the right to tell me how every other character that I've invented would speak and what they'd say and what their choices were. But he, of course, has those opinions. And the world of theatre is full of people going, I really loved your choice there. And that's really amazing the way you experimented with dancing out of step. But it would be really fun. It would be really amazing if we could just see you dance in step. Would you do that for me? That's how theatre directors talk. Bob Geldof comes in and goes, that's all shite. Will you? This is all bollocks. And, you know, so that's quite a challenge for that clash of cultures.
But you must have known precisely what you were getting into.
Didn't think we'd be quite that rude.
Okay.
And sometimes quite destructive. But in the end, his motive was always to make it a better show. It was never about his ego or about his sort of legacy. It was about that this is not very dramatic, this is not good theatre, and that's to be applauded. Mm.
Anyway, if Hans Zimmer, Pete Townsend and Trevor Horn think your musical is rocking...
Yeah, it is.
It'll do.
It's virtually sold out, I think. It's almost completely sold off. It's one to the Old Vic or the March the 30th, but we're hoping it will come back into the West End or something.
Okay. All of which is irrelevant. Apart from the reason I wanted to start talking about that, apart from the fact that hopefully it might make you feel good because it's a big thumbs up from your show, is how you compartmentalize time in terms of, is it time for a novel? Shall I write a play? Shall I do it? Is there any kind of planning, or is it just, that's an interesting idea, I think I've got some time? How do you parcel that up?
I think that, what you just said, actually, that's an interesting idea. That idea is really a novel, not a musical or a play. So there's various ideas in my file, and some of them are will never happen because they're just crazy high concept movie ideas. And others are like, well, that feels like a novel. And if I write a novel, hopefully, you know, the nice people at Transworld will publish it. So that's,
they are nice people at Transworld, aren't they?
They are very nice. Bill Scott Carr, bless him, is very kind
should
to
mention,
me.
Should mention, Bill Scott Carr is your editor.
Yes.
He's my editor.
He's had plenty of mentions on this podcast.
He has,
I think we all know
Terry
who he
Hayes.
Is
yeah, you know,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Imagine being Terry Hayes' author. So yeah. Terry writes the kind of 5,000 page, you know, books, which when they're sent in are like 25 million page affairs. Anyway, so Bill's got it easy, really.
With us. Yes. Absolutely. Well, so yeah, to answer your question, I mean, having just been in the world of theatre for quite a long time and worked with actors and directors and, you know, all the excitement and bustle of that, I actually quite fancy sitting in a room and writing a book now, just in terms of the pace of my life and a bit of quietness and just to have a bit of a break. So maybe it's that.
I want to come back to musicals a bit later on, but Family Politics, which Matt's described the cover, just take us into our world of progressive and regressive politics.
Well, as you alluded to, Simon, I'm, you know, wrote Things Can Only Get Better. That was a political memoir. I've been active in Labour politics all my life, but I sense that we are in a place now where politics is so divisive and people are so tribal about it and so diametrically opposed and not listening that I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to have a family where they were split down the middle? The idea of having these parents who think they're really liberal and progressive and inclusive and tolerant, when their son sends a message saying, you know, I'm coming home from university, there's something I want to talk to you about, they think, oh, we are fine with you being gay or trans or whatever. We're so tolerant. And of course, he walks in the door and says he's a conservative. And they're going, no, you can't be a conservative. It's a phase you're going through. You're just rebelling against us. It's like, you'll get over it. And they refuse to accept it. And I thought that's an interesting premise for a story. There's conflict in it. There's characters in it. And there's something to say about where we are now. And those three things, I think, are all important when you start a big project like this.
Well, it's enormous fun. It's also very profound, I think. But
thank you.
We follow our point of view character is Emma.
Yes.
So it's Emma who's married to Eddie.
Yes.
And he's standing in an election.
Yes.
Their son is Dylan, and he's the Conservative. But why did you decide to be Emma as our point of view character?
Because I wanted someone in the middle. I thought I could write this from the dad point of view, but the father son conflict I felt wasn't really the point of it. I felt it was trying to bring people together, and I felt that the relationship between a mother and son was more profound, I suppose, than a macho dad who was running for office. What I discovered in the process of that was that having her watch her son and husband argue was quite passive. And I wanted to make my female protagonist active and have an agenda. And when I landed on the realization that her husband going off to Westminster and becoming an MP would mean that she would be on her own all week, living in this house where they'd brought up a child, she'd be isolated. And she thought that would be fantastic. And that was such a breakthrough for me when it empowered her as a character. Before, it was like, oh, I'm helping my husband get elected and I'm watching my son do this. And I thought, that's too many women characters are written like that. And so when I made her active and she had this secret agenda, I think that was a breakthrough for me.
I think, so the first thing to say about this, John, is it's very funny. And obviously the first question people are going to ask before they decide to pick up your book is it funny? Because I could do with a laugh from John. I know his past work. And to reassure those people, yes, it is very funny. And it's also, importantly, it pokes fun at both Labour and Conservative. And as someone who would like to think of themselves as pretty much on the sort of progressive end of the spectrum, there are a number of times that I recognise myself being poked.
And myself. yourself and myself.
It's
yeah,
very, very.
Yeah.
There's one bit. I'm literally, this is one sentence, but I saw myself straight away here. As you say, it's the mother who's telling us the story, and she says at one point, "My husband was such a progressive feminist that he almost didn't bristle when his wife interfered with the fire." And I thought, "Yep, that's me. Yeah. That's hands off my fire. I'm in charge of the fire. If you touch it, things are going to go wrong." How important was it to you to be able to poke fun at both, at Labour Conservative?
Yes, it's a tricky one because I am tribally Labour, and I didn't want to write a book that says they're all as bad as each other. Why can't, you know, Israel and Palestine just sort it out? Clearly, it's more complex than that. And clearly, British politics is more complex than that. So I'm not saying they should just bang some heads together and get on better, because every time I try and advocate less hate in politics, you know, Suella Braverman will do something really hateful about keeping child refugees away from their parents. And I'm thinking, I try not to hate them. And then they do these hateful things. So I poke fun at the Labour people and the Tory people. But the point of the book isn't the Tory has to learn to be Labour. And the point of the book isn't, aren't these Tories all monsters? I worked quite hard to make him a credible Conservative, and a Conservative where you went, actually, that's quite a good point. So there's an argument about arms fairs. Now, I would always bristle at an arms fair, and I think, oh, God, how vile. Fancy spending your time at an arms fair. But I have him say, well, that's like being against war. Of course, we're all against arms fairs, but do you want British soldiers to be armed with pea shooters and catapults? That's what happens in war and armies. They have to be armed and they have to have weapons. So he's the sort of grown up in the room with these two sort of angry sixth formers who are his parents. And there's a sort of comedy in that. But there's also a sort of truth in it that we on the left are sometimes a bit too reactive and a bit too keen to be opposed to things instead of preparing for government.
What if it's actually easier to be funny about your own side? Because you are aware, because this is the world that you said that you live in, you're aware of the inconsistencies, you're aware of the clowns, you're aware of the idiots who are there. And actually writing about them is probably easier than writing about the Conservatives.
Yes, I mean, they used to say that the Conservative Party had a review at their conference taking the mickey out of the Labour Party, and the Labour Party had a review at their conference taking the mickey out of the Labour Party. And I think it's much better that we take the mickey out of ourselves, and it's more fun. And I, as you say, I know it better. So the Conservatives that I have in the book are not all sort of top hat wearing, you know, monocle wearing Jacob Rees-Mogg types. I have some ordinary Conservatives, plus I have a sort of grotesque Farage type Marc Francois monster, who even he has a slither of humanity by the end, I hope.
Was that a struggle?
Well, do you know what? I've spent a lot of time with politicians, and there's a whole side to them that we never see, which is helping people in their constituencies, changing lives through little breakthroughs for people. Theresa May will do it in Maidenhead. Even Boris Johnson may have done it in Uxbridge. Just sorting out issues that need referring upwards. And that is a big part of MP's job. And they have a pride in their town and a pride in that part of the job that we don't hear when we're watching them doing yaboo in Prime Minister's Question Time.
Yeah, you've mentioned Question Time there, and Question Time, the TV show, is one of the great sequences in the book. Really funny comedy sequence there. And the show itself, from your characters, comes in for a bit of a kicking.
Now, yes,
which leads
quite
me to
right too.
Two questions. One, have you ever been on it? And two, your feelings on Question Time, the TV show?
I have been on it several times. And I did okay because, A, I prepared and went in with some amusing, I hope, lines. And there's, you know, on a show like that, if you're just slightly funny, they're so grateful. And so I went down fine. But now to watch it, I can't bear it. It's like such a bear pit. And it's developed into this program where they're seeking clickbait and shocking little quotes to put on social media. And so it feeds this contrary, divisive form of politics that this binary politics that has got so much worse since the arrival of the internet, I think.
I know the guy who, well, I don't know whether he's still producing Question Time, but I had a conversation with him about this, and he made the point that there are a lot of people who say they hate Question Time and never watch Question Time. However, they're all watching the little clips on the clips that they put on social media do very well.
Yeah.
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views. And so he says, number one, there's a little bit of a hypocrisy about people saying they hate Question Time. But number two, he's saying the problem with that is that you don't see the context of it at all. You basically, all you see is this 20 seconds of someone in the crowd having a bit of a pop, and normally the Conservative MP flailing and saying, well, you know, trust us to stay the course, that kind of thing. And he says that those are enormously popular. The problem with it is that you're then left in a position where you're like, right, well, that party is going to destroy this country, or that party is our only hope.
Yes.
So therefore, if your party is doing badly, then the country is going to be in a hellscape within 3 years, which feels like it's not particularly productive.
That's where my politics are, really. I'm not. People give me a hard time for Keir Starmer not being more radical and more exciting right now. But he's 20 points ahead of the polls. And I'm going, we have to do, this is just me talking, we have to get rid of this government. And that's the only chance for any form of progressive politics. So get behind the very best option we've got. And we'll see what happens when they get into power. I'm no interest in morally pure opposition. There's nothing to be gained from helping the Tories. Nothing left wing about watching the Tories win election after election. And that is the position and the division between the two, married couple in this book, really. Eddie calls himself Red Ted, and he has refused to get into coalition with the Liberals and the Tories on the council. And he could have made a difference there. And so all politics is about compromise. I consider myself way to the left of Keir Starmer and of Tony Blair, but I cheered their successes. And I understand that you can believe one thing and, you know, have another one in a manifesto that you present to the British people.
What happens in your Question Time in your book?
The young Conservative son is in there on his cricket jumper with the Tory councillors that Question Time has come to their town, and he says something rather careless about, which sounds a bit racist. And if you hear the whole sentence, it's not that racist, but it is clipped down for social media because he's saying, I'm not saying that. And they cut out the I'm not saying that. And
it's a very dishonest edit.
Yeah, it is.
It is a very dishonest. You know what? It's funny you should say that, because I had a slightly more complex point about Israel and Jewish people. And when the October the 7th happened in Gaza, Bill, who we're talking about, said, I think you should have another look at this. And my agent was saying, I think you should have another look at this. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to rewrite it. So I consulted Mr. Jewish intellectual himself, David Baddiel. I sent him the clip and said, is this okay? He goes, no, I don't think it is, John. I went, oh, okay, damn, I've got to rewrite it then. So that's how it ended up. And he had the idea of saying, I'm not saying that. So that's his contribution.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Well,
yeah.
But David does think very deeply about this stuff, as well as being funny.
He's very thoughtful and very smart about it. And I respect his opinion and his experience. So I was happy to make that change based on that, because I was hoping, I sent it to him expecting him to go, no, they're being ridiculous. And I went, no, they're all right, John. And I was very privileged that I have, you know, can count David as a friend that I can consult on these things. But I suppose that's part of what I'm talking about, compromise, listening, and changing your mind.
There's a moment that if I can find it, it's on page 113, which is an author visit. Okay, an author visit to a prison.
I've done that. Oh, no, I'm sorry, but this is exactly me. This is exactly my experience. Yes.
So just set it up. So we have someone who sounds a little bit like Robert Harris, but obviously isn't. C.J. Baird.
Yes.
All right, tell us what you've got him to do here.
Well, he's just reading an extract of his historical novel. And this was what happened to me when I went to do. I've been to prison many times, but the one time I remember people saying, "How much money do you make out of your books?" Oh well, I get by. I have my needs are modest, so enough. So what? £1 million? No, not £1 million. And the sort of librarian interjects with, "Well, we're here to talk about John's books. So if we could talk, have your books been adapted for telly?" Yes, they were on television. You make a lot of money from that. And then it was, "What sort of car do you drive?" And I said, "Well, I've got a little Golf." And they all, as a room, went, Ugh. Golf? Ugh, what a waste of time. This bloke hasn't even got a Ferrari or a Rolls Royce, and he's come here to talk about writing. We want to make a load of money making learning how to write like you do, right. And you haven't got a golf.
So CJ Baird is you, basically.
Yes.
His experience is this experience, and it's just the excruciating moment where he's given like a synopsis of his work in the Austro-Hungarian Empire or or something like that. And then he finishes and then says, he closes the cover meaningfully and says, lots to think about there. Does anyone have a question? No hands go up. Absolutely no. And it's that terrible, terrible moment where you're thinking, okay, I have
nothing to offer here.
There is absolutely nothing. And then, as you say, all the questions come in. How much do you make from your book? Are you a multimillionaire? And the reason I felt your pain there, or CJ Baird's pain, is that the prisoner's reaction was exactly the same as what I used to do school visits, right? When my books came out to start with. And they all asked the same question. And that is, how old are you? Maybe the prisoners weren't so sure of that. How much money do you earn? And is it going to be a film? And even if the person next to them had asked, how old are you? If that was the question that the other person had prepared, they would still ask exactly the same question. So I think that's fantastic. So the experience here is an eyewitness account of what happened the last time you did a Q&A at a prison cell.
It is, I'm afraid. That's how little imagination I have. I just put my funny experiences into my books. The one thing I didn't put in, that I took a box of Quality Street for the prisoners, and the very first person who took the box to pass around just stuffed his pockets with loads of these chocolates, and nobody argued. And I went, oh, I meant them to show. I'll better say nothing. This bloke looks like he's in charge.
I did a visit in Dartmoor Prison.
Where one of your books was set.
That's right. And this guy came up to me and said, I didn't do it, you know.
Oh, okay.
And I went, I'm sure. Could you write to my MP? Because I'm in here for all the wrong reasons. And it was just one of those classic moments. And apparently that always happens. It's that, if you're going to go and do a reading in a prison, they'll all tell you, I didn't do it.
And they all think you can get them out.
Yes, absolutely. Because I'm a powerful member of the media.
Yeah, the liberal elite.
So when Emma, who's our mum, finds out that Dylan is a Tory, right at the early on, she's beside herself, you write this. Had he met her at the local Conservative Association, was she 75 years old? Maybe the apps on his phone included a special Tory Tinder where you could swipe far right and hook up with bigots in your area to explore your secret fantasies about top-rate tax cuts and the abolition of the BBC. So I'm just reading that out as an example of the delights. Now, I imagine when you read that, you wrote that with a flourish, and you wrote it with relish, and you thought, that's good, that's going to stay in.
I suppose so, yes. There are jokes that you write, and you think, that's a good joke, and it sits there, and then sometimes people come back to you and go, I don't get that joke, and sometimes it's just you, but sometimes you think, perfect. So the opening paragraph is something like, Prince Hamlet moved home after university, and look how that turned out. I just think, but everyone knows about Hamlet. They know that everyone dies. And so that's a neat little way of talking about young people moving back home. And I had some fun, of course, with the idea, and that's quite zeitgeisty, of young adults moving back home after university, because lots of people are going through that. And normally the parents are being berated for their, centrist politics. So I thought it'd be interesting way of flipping it to make it that they're being lambasted for being too left-wing. So, but all the stuff about the mugs in the bedroom and the washing left in the machine and the food being eaten from the fridge, this was all grist to my mill as well.
Yes.
And I gave it a political slant by suggesting that maybe he was, treating them like a couple of peasants who were his servants,
Yeah, you've already touched, John, on the importance of compromise, and certainly towards the end of the book, I took it as you basically saying, can we get rid of the purity tests and just instead concentrate on, rather than being a sort of party of protest, be one that's actually, in power. There's a great question, which my instinct is, you've asked this question, or you've been in the room when it's been asked, where one of your characters says, final question, imagine if the magic genie of socialism offered you this choice, the Tories in power for decades, but all your Labour friends admiring how hard you keep fighting them, or the Conservatives out of power for decades, but everyone thinks you've become a Tory.
Yes.
As I say, it felt to me like this is a question either you have posed to people directly in with beads of frustration running down your face, or you've been in the room when that's been...
I invented that test for this book, and it came to my head for that book. But I think that has been the frustration of my entire political activism, is the posture politics of people on the left who want to show how left-wing they are and want to be prolier than thou. And yet, when you get something, like I campaigned for a new state school in Lambeth, where I live, and there were people alongside us who were great campaigners. And then when we got the school and I became chair of governors, they were still against us. They were still on the outside protesting, throwing stones, you know. And it's like, no, we've got this. Let's make it work. And I think there were so many people on the left a significant number of people on the left who want to have a go at Keir Starmer because it's more comfortable than going, actually, this is a really tough choice. This budget that is going to happen when Labour come to power is going to be so difficult. How do we make it work? That's a constructive way forward. Being down with centrists is easy. And lazy, I think.
Yeah.
You said on, I think I've got this quote, you said on Newsnight that satire serves the establishment.
I was being a bit provocative there, I think.
Okay, well, I'm inviting you to carry on that thought because it's always held up maybe by people who remember, the golden days of satire in the establishment club and then on, that was the week that was and that kind of thing, that it was the scourge of the establishment.
Well, Peter Cook, when he launched the establishment, said, I'm going to bring back the sort of German cabaret of the 1930s that did such a fantastic job of stopping Adolf Hitler. Mm. So he was aware of that as well. My point was that I think that a joke and a comedy is a sort of release of tension. So you're really angry about the government, you laugh at the government, and then it's processed and it's dealt with. Whereas in countries where you're not allowed to have satire or comedy or criticism of the government, that anger builds up. And places like, Iran or, North Africa before the Arab Spring, it bursts out in a sort of form of protest. I'm not saying that, if if Iran had had Spitting Image and Weekending, then those places would have been more liberal. I just think there's something about the process of the mocking superiority that comes with satire that makes you feel better about enduring a terrible government that maybe prevents violent insurrection and maybe processes it for us in a different way.
I think it was Michael Palin, certainly one of the Pythons or a Python producer, I realise I'm making this very vague, who said, in some countries there'd be a whole class of revolutionaries who would be right at the front of the barricades and campaigning and throwing bricks and so on. In Britain, they're all producers in the BBC Light Entertainment Department.
I love that.
But it's true. That's where a lot of the radicals are. Yeah. Rather than on the streets, they're actually making comedy.
Well, comedy, or drama. I mean, yes, it's true. When I was writing on Spitting Image, I was probably one of the least left-wing people there. Some of them were in the Socialist Workers' Party. And I think if you were sort of creative and funny and were right-wing, you're probably making 10 times as much money working in advertising or going off and just choosing to be in the city. But it is I think to be a writer is a sort of progressive thing because you're looking at alternatives and you're looking at humanity. There are, of course, conservative writers, but there's not many whose work I love. I say that. I don't know. P.G. Wodehouse is quite fun and, Jerome J. Carone was quite conservative and I enjoy their humour too.
Maybe they're kind of apolitical.
Well, conservatives always think they're apolitical. People say to me, I'm not a political person, I always vote conservative.
Yeah.
And that's an actual conservative councillor said to me, I'm not a political person. You're a conservative. You're elected politicians. What are you talking about?
You've had an amazing few years with Broadway musicals, West End musicals.
I know. Where did that come from?
Something Rotten, Mrs. Doubtfire. We mentioned Just One Day, at the beginning. That jump to musicals came from where?
That came from back in the noughties, I worked on the original Chicken Run film. And I met the main writer of that film, Carey Kirkpatrick. And he so loved my first novel, The Best a Man Can Get, that he wanted to write and direct a movie of it. So he got a big deal with Kathy Kennedy's company. And I was flown out to Hollywood and we sat around trying to write this screenplay. Film never got made, of course. That's always the way with these things. But while we were there, he pitched this musical idea to me, which was Something Rotten. And I started to show my...
Should say that's the name.
Something Rotten. Yeah, yeah. Something Rotten, yes. So sort of, it's about the invention of the musical in Shakespeare's time. So these two writers can't get a break because Shakespeare's got all the theatres sewn up. So they go and see Nostradamus, and he tells them about... He foresees the musical. And our hero is like, wait, what? People are saying their lines and they suddenly burst into song? That is the stupidest thing that I have ever heard. And so when Kerry pitched this to me, I said, well, where would you want to write that for? And he went, well, for Broadway. I said, well, that's not going to happen in my British can-do way. But it did. He asked me to write it with him. And I went back to my wife and said, shall I write a musical? She went, yes. So... we wrote this thing. His brother writes songs with Kerry. And so I was just co-writing the book with Kerry. But what an experience to be in my 50s and learning how to write musicals, learning to write for the stage. And it was a very steep learning curve. I was writing jokes that just didn't work on a stage because everything's a wide shot. Do you know what I mean? Everything on, you can't do a close-up on a piece of paper or close-up on a sign. I was saying lights up on sign. The director was going, that's not going to read in the dress back of the dress circle. You know. So you've got to learn a new... way of writing and a new new language. But it was a sort of it was a moderate hit. It ran for 2 years on Broadway. I got a Tony nomination and we got 10 Tony nominations.
What do you mean a moderate hit? That's incredible.
Well it didn't do a Hamilton or a Book of Mormon where, you know, the momentum of it brings it straight over here. So it's not played over here yet. It has, you know, been around the world and it will come here at some point. But I was writing musicals and because of that, we were asked to do Mrs. Doubtfire, the musical, which is running at the Shaftesbury Theatre now in London. And it's been great fun, I have to say. I'm very grateful to be given these opportunities when I could have just been, you know, sitting in my office just writing books and being a bit lonely.
Yeah. But I can imagine, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, the attraction of just you and your laptop, presumably writing a story, as opposed to checking it with a vast production team.
Yeah. And after about a week of writing on my own, I'll be going, oh, it'd be nice to be in a rehearsal room with lots of actors and writers. I mean, the other thing that really keeps you on your toes being with a load of young people, I always think that my points of reference and my sort of humour points are those of everyone else. But of course, now I'm getting on a bit. And so when I make a joke about Phil Collins jumping on Concorde to go to America, all the young actors are going, what's Concorde? And it's like, so wow. And you go, oh yeah, I'm old. So you have to sort of, you know, tailor your material a bit.
I thought you were going to say, who's Phil Collins?
they're probably that as well. Yeah. They know the songs actually. What's interesting about all that music is it's, it may be from the 80s, but the music has endured even if they don't know what Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp was.
But In the Air Tonight is certainly known by...
Yeah,
by teenagers, you know. I mean, because it's on. You know, it is just there.
Yes, much of the music is like that, and that was a factor when I was choosing some of it. So something like what's the Simple Minds? Don't You Forget About Me was made huge by that film, The Breakfast Club. So it has had an extra life. Whereas there are some songs like Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who, which didn't make it because no one now seems to know that song. And it's a huge song to me, but young people just don't know that song.
What is captivating your attention at the moment? Politics aside, what are you going to be working on next, John?
I've got a two-book deal with lovely Bill Scott Carr. So I've got maybe a novel idea and maybe a non-fiction idea that they're very early days and I sort of have a rule of trying to get it down on paper before I start talking about it to anyone, because it sort of might get a bit lost if I start mumbling about half-formed ideas. I've got lots of things just coming to an end now with the novel and with the To Promote and these two shows running in London and Chicken Run on Netflix. I did actually write a play. So I've written a play that is sitting in a drawer and maybe I'll try and dig that out and see if that's
going to... Was that a lockdown experiment?
Yeah, it was actually. Yeah, it was the first uncommissioned thing I've written for like 30 years. And
so apart from this new book you've got out, the play which you're going to work with, the movie that's on Netflix,
yes,
you say,
yes,
and the two musicals that are running, it's...
I know.
Not much going on.
What are you doing with your time?
I'm going to have to give up my paper round, I think, at this.
When do you get a chance to see Fulham?
I get to see them every week. I've got my season ticket and, I've been going along regularly. But I've even watched the away games now on a naughty streamer, which I probably shouldn't confess to. But yeah, I get advert for Thai soda drinks on during away games. But yeah, and the worst thing is, I've written this book about this family where the son comes home and says he's a conservative. My daughter, who's like 28 now, has just said she's going to support Arsenal. I mean, it's just like I'm living my
really?
Book. Yeah, it's like
you have failed.
She was at Fulham as a baby. And she's been coming along intermittently over the years.
Embarrassment.
I know, it's the shame she's bringing on the family.
Why? How? What? I can't.
Because she's got some friends in North London. They're all mad Arsenal fans. And she started going on to see the women's team. And I'm going to show her the will and show her where her name is crossed out, because it is a deal breaker.
I was enjoying this interview until you lowered the tone. John O'Farrell's new book is Family Politics. It's fantastic. It's very, very funny. And it's kind of like an antidote to all the stress and bother. Even though it is about stress and bother, and it is about parenting, and it is about politics, it's a joy to read.
Thank you, Simon.
John, thank you very much indeed. There'll be more with John O'Farrell in our Q&A session, which will be with you in a few days.